Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of Not in a Creepy Way, the podcast where the brothers Anderson will dig deep into the movies. The brothers Anderson are. This is Eric, he's the oldest one. The producer who makes it fun, gotta give him the credit. He's good with the edits. He's been the driving force since they begun. Next we got brother Jay. He just the movies that they play. The sip in the middle, Jay is gonna be a little more critical, analytical when he communicates. And lastly we got Drew, the finally family member of this group. He decides if the movie's worth it. Right kind of guy, that's for certain. Three chatty brothers with a family base. Need an excuse to talk away. Dichotomy of personalities. All you really need to do is press play. One podcast talk show. Hit the app if you want to catch an episode. They talk movies till they go off on a tangent flow and maybe ramble. That's the brothers Anderson. So sit back with closed eyes, let them take you away. Unless you're driving, keep them open to that case. We got Eric, Drew, and brother Jay. Welcome you to Not in a Creepy Way.
Hey. Welcome, this is Eric.
This is brother Jay.
This is Drew. And brother Jay, are you wearing a Seahawks jersey?
No.
Oh, okay.
It's just a green and black shirt. Sorry.
All right. It looks very green and blue. I support it.
Tonight, we're going to talk about the 1999 Michael Mann movie, The Insider, based on the Vanity Fair article, The Man Who Knew Too Much, by Marie Brenner. Drew, this is on your list.
Yeah, I thought, given what's been going on in the news, I thought it might be interesting to watch a movie about a whistleblower. A movie directed by maybe the greatest living director.
So, as I was watching the movie, I realized there was a definite lack of helicopters.
No, there wasn't. There was an entire helicopter scene. Rip Torn was in the helicopter with the other dude who told him, like, you're full of shit.
Okay. I know there's a plane scene. I will take your word for it. Okay, helicopters.
Okay. So, it's a Michael Mann movie. No. now you're going to suffer the wrath.
Was there a helicopter in The Insider? Is that what you're putting in?
That's what I'm looking for.
Okay. So, Drew, while Jason's on this quixotic mission, when was the first time you watched this movie, and what'd you think, and what do you think this time?
I saw this movie in the theater. It was not quite what I expected. You know, I saw it mainly because I loved Heat. And this was Michael Mann's first movie after Heat. So I was very excited about it. He returned with Al Pacino, had Russell Crowe in it. Russell Crowe was about to go on quite a run of well-regarded movies. And so I didn't really know anything about it, but went in pretty blind and watched it. And I was expecting an action movie. This was not an action movie. But as it turns out, more of a thriller than probably it deserved to be. And I really enjoyed it back in the day, but it's not a movie I've returned to. So this is only the second time I've seen it.
Now, what did you think of it this time?
I liked it a lot. It was it's been so long that I didn't really remember all the beats. So watching it this time, I'd forgotten all of the office politics that went on in the second half of the movie. So I thought, you know, the big climax was him actually testifying in open court. And then I was perplexed about how there could be another hour left to the movie.
Yeah, the movie changes protagonists.
Mm-hmm. But it was good. I think all the performances are really good. Russell Crowe's doing a thing, but he's good. Pacino's just kind of doing late career Pacino.
Yeah, I was going to say, he's definitely just Pacino. And Christopher Plummer, They made him upright, and he's already kind of got the voice, but he's more Christopher Plummer than he is Mike Wallace.
Yeah, sure. I was going to say, he kept his Christopher Plummer accent.
Pretty much, yeah.
But he was good.
Oh, he was good.
Really good.
Yeah. So, Brother Jay, had you seen the movie before?
Nope.
And what did you think of it now? Or what did you think of it now that you've seen it?
I thought it was a very excellent movie, and I had never seen it before, so going into it, I was more surprised when I was watching it with all the actors in it that I hadn't seen it. So I was pretty surprised.
Yeah, I hadn't seen it before either, even though it's definitely my kind of movie. I mean, it's a Michael Mann movie, so I like that already. But it's a movie about 60 Minutes, and I grew up loving 60 Minutes. 60 Minutes was the shit back in those days. Like, it broke news. It was edgy. Like, you were scared if Mike Wallace showed up at your business. So do you guys remember 60 Minutes fondly or not?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, it was a Sunday dinner staple.
Well, it was a sometimes Sunday dinner staple based on the disposition and mood of our dear father.
It's true. It was one of the things you had to fight for sometimes. I think I got voted down, not that it was much of a democracy, but until you guys were a little bit older. Because I was into seeing it, and you guys were still into seeing, like, The Wonderful World of Disney, which was fine. But Disney didn't kick down any doors and expose stuff like 60 Minutes did.
Was there a weird timing issue when we were really young about when it was on?
Well, I mean, I'm sure. I mean, everything was tape delayed, so.
Yeah.
I don't think it was on early, if that's what you mean. Although there may have been a couple of years.
I remember it being on really late a couple times.
Maybe. And, of course, a lot of it depended on football, too, because that was all tape delayed as well.
Okay. 2 hours, 23 minutes, 28 seconds.
Oh, it's a long movie.
No, that's where the helicopter scene is.
Oh, at the very, very end?
Mm-hmm.
Holy crap. Okay. Well,
they're helicoptering around New York.
Yeah, okay. Okay. All right. Holy.
Because they were talking in the helicopter, and the one dude says, you know, they conclude most of it seems pretty unsubstantiated and rip-torn, which this is kind of a wasted performance for him, but, you know, he was there. And then there was like the he looks at him and he says, you're just full of shit, John.
I don't know. I thought rip-torn was kind of good. I mean, his character, he didn't have a lot of lines, but I thought he delivered them well.
Tell me there wasn't a helicopter in it. Boom.
Okay. Mea culpa, Brother Jay. I'm sorry. You'll get my written apology.
Thanks to Eric's wonderful editing, the listeners will not have to sit through Jason watching the entire movie again like we just did.
Exactly, yeah. Drew is actually choking, and he fell down on the floor. We called an ambulance that got him resuscitated, and he got him on some oxygen. And, just now we're all back together.
So... it was interesting for me. First of all, one of the things that I really had a problem with was the portrayal of his wife.
Yeah, she was not seen in a very super positive light.
No, it was really, it was, I mean, and I don't know how, I mean, obviously this is dramatized because it's a movie, but boy, they really made her out to be just this selfish, self-centered, kind of terrible, not supportive. It's all about me, even though you're going through this kind of thing. I don't know.
I think it's, I can see where that would just be the other half of the group of friends that the Blind Side Sandra Bullock hung out with.
Well, it's interesting because his wife was played by Diane Venora, who was also in Heat.
Yes, where she played Pacino's wife.
Pacino's wife. And she was also really self-centered in that movie, but in a much more compelling way.
Mm-hmm.
She had much more of an impact on the story, even though she wasn't involved in the action at all. Very similar to this. She was just only tangentially involved because of the protagonist.
She was also in The Jackal.
Yeah, which is a movie we still need to see.
I'm not sure we do.
Oh, there you go, Jason. That's the other one we're going to watch in October.
I've already watched it again.
No, well, I'll watch it again. I've got it. That's been on the calendar for a long time.
Yeah, I've seen it relatively recently.
Then we'll have to. Well, that will do. You'll be able to listen to us talk about it and know what we're talking about.
It's not good.
That and The Love Guru.
Actually, no, you should put, no. No, I don't mean we should together. Put the, I was going to say, The Jackal should go with Gorky Park because they both have Russian roots.
There we go. You have just saved 35 minutes of podcasting.
Way to go.
If that.
I'm trying to be a team player here. Actually, that's what I'm saying.
Let's,
she reminded
me. I can go to the notes here.
She reminded me of,
39 minutes.
She reminded me very much of another actress, and I'm trying to figure out who it was.
I was going to say, if you're talking about beep and beep and beep, who, you know, we know from Mom and Dad's Friends, you're wrong, because I think those people are charming, lovely people. So, oh, well, before we get into the guts of it, which we should, because I think it's an interesting story, but my first thought was, I was kind of dreading it, because I knew it wasn't going to be an action movie, and it was 230-something minutes long, or 2 hours and something minutes, sorry. So I found that a little daunting, and I've had a kind of a long, busy week at work, but I watched it last night, all in one sitting, and was captivated. I was worried I was going to fall asleep through it. No, it was fine. The tension is such that it keeps you interested in the movie. And yeah, mm-hmm. There's a pivot halfway through where you're changing stories, kind of. Also, let's talk about Al Pacino's hair. What is that? Is that him? Is that like long thinning hair, like all moosed up, or is that?
Yes.
Okay, I was gonna say, because it's not quite wig Al Pacino or Al it's not wig Al Pacino, but yeah, it's a thing.
Yeah, it's definitely teased to provide volume.
So, starts out in Lebanon. Oh, sorry, in Lebanon. We're not in Missouri. Hezbollah militants are escorting producer Lowell Bergman, played by Al Pacino, who we know from All the Godfathers, Heat, and Insomnia, to Hezbollah founder Sheikh Fadlala, where Lowell convinces him to be interviewed by Mike Wallace, Christopher Plummer. And we know him from Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country, and 12 Monkeys. And, I know Christopher Plummer from a lot of, like, horror movies, like Hammer films and stuff.
Wasn't he also in Dragnet?
Yes, he was in Dragnet. He was also at wow. Count Dooku, right?
No.
Who am I thinking? That's Christopher, Lee. Okay, sorry. See, those are interchangeable too. Yeah.
Yes, Mike Wallace was not Sauron.
Yeah. Okay. And which of them? Plummer was Plummer is Kevin Spacey, right?
Yes.
Okay.
By the way, Diane Venora, she reminded me of Jessica Lange.
Okay.
Yeah, I can see that. In this movie, sure. In Heat, not at all. In Heat, she had a totally different style and hair and everything.
Halfway through this movie, I thought it was Jessica Lange until I realized it couldn't be. I'm like, oh, no, it couldn't be. But that kind of the mannerisms and the speech and the kind of the makeup made her look that way. So, again, I thought it was a great performance. But
did you recognize his kids, by the way? The actors?
Yes.
One was from Halloween.
Well, there's Haley Steinfeld, who was in a bunch of Pepsi commercials back in the day, right?
Mm-hmm.
And she's now like an adult actress. Was she the one in Halloween, the new one?
No.
Am I thinking of it? Is she working a lot lately? I'm trying to think without actually looking it up.
No, the little girl, she wasn't the one who was like in Halloween 5?
No, that was, oh, don't tell me, Danielle somebody.
Oh, okay.
Danielle Harris. No, the other one, the older asthmatic girl, she was, Renee Olstead, who was in the TV show Still Standing, and she's quite a accomplished, like, jazz singer, like, torch singer. She does a great version of Hit the Road, Jack.
Jack, and don't you come back no more, no more, no more, no more. Hit the road, Jack, and don't you come back no more. Hit the road, Jack, and don't you come back no more, no more, no more, no more. Hit the road, Jack, and don't you come back no more. Don't you treat me so mean. You're the meanest old man that I ever seen. I guess if you say so, I have to pack my things and go. That's the right of the road, Jack, and don't you come back no more, no more, no more, no more. Hit the road, Jack, and don't you come back no more.
Oh, the younger daughter was Haley Eisenberg. Hallie Eisenberg?
Hallie Eisenberg, not, yes.
Not well, Haley Steinfeld.
I don't know who that is. I probably have it written down here or whatever, but Hallie Eisenberg, she was in the Pepsi commercials, right? Or some commercials. I don't even know.
Yes.
Does she do stuff today, or am I thinking of the Haley Steinfeld girl?
Haley Steinfeld does stuff today. She was in True Grit. She got nominated for an Oscar.
Okay, that's who I'm mixing it up with. That makes sense. Okay, so Stuff Eric Gets Wrong, Part 6. So then, by the way, as we're looking at Hezbollah and 60 Minutes and the tension and the incredible drama of being Lowell Bergman, we have, because, you know, basically like news producers are journalists just as news presenters are journalists, depending on who you're talking about. We have, and apparently Lowell Bergman and Mike Wallace have been working together for many, many, many years, and they were sort of a team.
14 years.
Oh. Then we flash to Louisville, Kentucky, where we meet Dr. Jeffrey Wiegand, played by...
It's Louisville, by the way.
Sorry. In Lebanon, Kentucky, we meet Dr. Jeffrey Wiegand, who is played by...
Wiegand.
God damn it. In Louisville, Kentucky, we meet Dr. Jeffrey Wiegand, played by Russell Crowe, who we know from State of Play. By the way, Russell Crowe, this was before The Gladiator, is that right?
Yes.
Because he looks like he has been bulking up for The Gladiator. It looks like they're trying to hide his gigantic physique.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just Gladiator.
Yeah. Oh, sorry. All right, Tiger Wood. So, Dr. Wiegand, Russell Crowe, he's packing his belongings. By the way, it seems like Dr. Wiegand, I don't know if he's on the spectrum, but as portrayed here, he's a little uptight.
Yes.
Wound very, very tight.
Yes, he definitely seems like somebody who has been to anger management classes unsuccessfully.
Against his will.
Yes.
Yeah. So he is packing his belongings and he leaves his Brown and Williamson office, returning to his wife, Lane, played by Diane Verona from Heat, and two children, one of them who suffers from acute asthma. Now, Lane is, you know, she's your typical suburban southern mom, stay-at-home wife kind of thing. No, she's going back to school. By the way, happy birthday to Derek, by the way. The big 5-0. DM.
For real?
Yeah. Today he's 25 again.
DM 5-0. Anyway, so she doesn't know that he's been fired. He has been fired from his job. He was like, what, the director of something or other, like the head scientist?
Research, I think.
Yeah.
By the way, it's Leanne.
Okay, so his wife, Lebanon, returning. Anyway, so we end up going to Berkeley, California, where Lowell Bergman receives what I think was a mail bomb, but turns out to be an anonymous package containing documents related to tobacco company Philip Morris.
Yeah, how the times have changed that, you know, if somebody got a big package that was all kind of taped up on their porch, that they just eagerly open it up.
Yeah, I'm sorry, you ever see a package like that? I expect a robot to open it. Because it will not be me.
Or my neighbor, I don't like.
He's also in a profession where he seeks out information and sources. So this probably happens to him a lot.
By the way, also, he's getting this weird of a package, as we find out, just a couple months before he's going to be the first news agency on the scene when they arrest the Unabomber.
Yeah, this is during a time when the Unabomber was active.
The Unabomber. That's going to be my Halloween costume.
Hello, baby.
Boom. Boom.
Oh, dear. Okay.
Well, now Brother Jay is like in the throes of death.
Oh, jeez. Oh, my God. It's been a long week. I'm so tired.
Well, I do like the way that the story is crafted such that how these guys meet and know that there's a story is kind of interesting. Not completely linear. in that, not the storytelling, this is a bad choice of words for me.
You pronounced it right.
It's kind of like a meet cute. Because
how does Lowell get in touch with Wigand?
Well, that's the thing is,
like,
so
what connects them?
Well, Lowell calls somebody he knows, who is somehow related to the tobacco industry or knows whatever, and says, "Hey, I need someone to translate these documents." He goes, "Oh, I know somebody." Mm-hmm. So that guy calls up Wigand, and I'm guessing, and this is not stated, but I'm guessing it was like, if he knows this guy's going to be paid for his expertise, he's just probably throwing this guy who just got fired, like, you know, a little tip. So Lowell expects Wigand. This guy is just like an employee, like a paid person, subject matter expert, to come in and tell him what these documents mean. And Wigand is so weird about it that it's instantly apparent that there's more to this Wigand guy than just somebody who knows how to read what these reports mean. And that intrigues Lowell. Partly because Wigand just, again, is continually weird about it. Because one thing about Wigand is Wigand takes things very seriously. And he has a non-disclosure agreement with
Wigand. He's an intense dude.
Yes, he is. So he's bitter and he has an axe to grind and he is angry because he was fired, but he was angry before he was fired, which is what got him fired. Mm-hmm. And he definitely has an axe to grind, but he also keeps these things internally because he doesn't seem like a guy, again, he only expresses his anger in short but powerful bursts. and he doesn't deal with stress very well, as we find out about his history later. He may have had stress-related stuff. So it's all very secret for Wigand, and so Lowell, like I said, is intrigued. And it turns out Wigand has a reason to be concerned because, you know, these tobacco companies, his in particular, who's the third largest tobacco company in the United States, they have secrets to keep, and they will keep them with extreme prejudice. And the chief of security or whatever, the heavy security guy, did you recognize him? Does the name Gary Sandy ring a bell? You know, have you ever wondered whatever became of me?
Oh,
I've been living
on the air
in Cincinnati. Cincinnati WKRP. Yeah. He's Andy Travis.
I did recognize him.
Yeah. He looked like he got out of the gym too.
He surprisingly has aged well considering the time span between I've seen him on TV and a movie.
Yeah, although this was 20 years ago, so I may he may.
I guess that's true too. Now he was unlikable.
Yeah, perfectly so.
Yeah.
Drew, do you have fond memories of WKRP?
Yeah. Not really clear, strong memories, but yeah, some of them. I remember Les Nessman's office walls.
Do you remember, as God is my witness, I thought turkeys could fly?
Yes. Yes, I do. Yes.
Really, that's all you need to know. That should tell the whole story. Seems like Dr. Wigand would make walls like that if he didn't have access to real walls at his job.
Indeed.
No, he would need them. He would just browbeat people into building walls for him.
He would squint walls into existence. So, we have the Brown & Williamson CEO, Thomas Sandifer, played by Michael Gambon from The King's Speech. And here's we have this whole tension about the expanded confidentiality agreement. And they are pretty well openly threatening him.
Yes. Certainly with financial ruin, if not physical harm.
Yes. And he knows it. And he's not a dummy, this Wigand guy. Like, he knows what's going on. It's not that he is super smart and not savvy. He's savvy also. But here's another thing. Having watched A Beautiful Mind does not help this movie's Russell Crowe performance.
How so?
Well, because, you know, I don't know whether you're supposed to be unsure about whether he is paranoid or not. Well, in A Beautiful Mind, you know, it's even more of a question. So is it the same character? Is he inventing these things? Did he put his own bullet in the mailbox?
I never got the sense that he was paranoid.
No? Brother Jay?
He was paranoid, but he was justified. I mean, paranoia.
You don't think he was unhinged, though?
No. Well, how do you define unhinged? I mean, he was running around with guns, guns out in his yard while not securing his premises and allowing his children to run a boot. So that's a little unhinged. So, you know, I think that in his situation, it's hard to tell because, you know, you're defending your family. Of course, your family's peril and there's potentially somebody doing malevolent things on your property. But still, I mean, that's some wackadoo behavior.
Well, and of course, this is a time where Big Tobacco was still Big Tobacco. I mean, this is a time where Big Tobacco was probably at its peak.
Well, Big Tobacco is still Big Tobacco. They're just not Big Tobacco in the United States.
Well, maybe. And they're still, I mean, again, if you don't think that that all these vaping companies, the legitimate ones, are run by Big Tobacco, you're fooling yourself. And again, much like vaping now, there's a lot of mystery science that's happening, selective science. And it seems laughable now that they put the seven dwarves, as they called them, the seven CEOs of the tobacco companies on Capitol Hill in a deposition and made them stare at and testifying, made them say for the record that they were unaware, that they did not believe that nicotine or tobacco caused cancer, nicotine was addictive. I think the question was nicotine addictive, right? Mm-hmm. They said, I do not believe so.
Mm-hmm.
I don't believe there is any quid pro quo.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah. I didn't hear any. Oh, you mean when I was actually in on the call? That time? I don't recollect that. But yeah, and actually, I guess we could talk about vaping and stuff if this were not such a rich period of news that we can talk about other stuff at the end of the during housekeeping.
Vaping is the least of my worries at this point.
Fucking A, right, yes.
Dying from some kind of lung disease at this point sounds almost attractive in comparison.
I don't know. It seems slow and ugly, but, you know, again, slow and ugly.
The last 2 years haven't been slow and ugly?
They might get uglier. But we'll get there when we get there. So, back to this movie.
Shut your whore mouth.
So, we have... this whole tension where Wiegand is, and by the way, he needs to keep Brown and Williams in his good graces because he has a daughter with a serious medical condition. And these were the days before you could get a new insurance with pre-existing conditions. Those days are coming again. So you kept your fucking health insurance, whatever you had to do. His severance package included a generous amount of money over the course of several years to keep him in line and also health insurance. And when you have a high-maintenance kid, you're going to keep your health insurance. Also, of course, yeah, his wife comes off as a little bit shallow in that she has a husband who's an executive and keeps her and her children in a relatively lavish lifestyle. I mean, not super rich, but they are definitely, like, upper middle class for sure, if not lower high class. So, you know, what, is she going to go get a job at the Piggly Wiggly? This is not the life she's envisioned.
True. I mean, when they had to downsize, though, their house was still pretty nice.
Oh, yeah. No,
I think they went from a really super nice house in a really affluent neighborhood to a decent house in an okay neighborhood.
Yeah.
And considering that, you know, where they were living, you know.
And for the average person, they were still living in a pretty snazzy house in a pretty snazzy neighborhood.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Perspective, though, right? It's all about perspective. Wiegand and Bergman play a little bit of cat and mouse so that they come to an understanding where Wiegand wants to talk, but he can't really talk. But Lowell's like, well, if you can either tell me or not tell me, but if you got something to say, I'm a person you should say it to. So they're kind of like being coy with each other, but they each know what each other wants. And Wiegand, as it turns out, he wants to drop a dime on the tobacco companies. And he's got dimes to drop. Well, okay, actually, the dime, the metaphor just has refers to make a phone call. But anyway, he's got tea to spill. If that's the right metaphor, I'm not sure.
That works.
Then they have to decide, okay, how are they going to do this? Because, of course, Big Tobacco has big money and they will sue the crap out of you. This, by the way, is still a case with big corporations and rich people today. They will bury you in lawyering until you cannot recover. Or at least that's the plan. But one way they figured that they could actually air this interview and have him not break his confidentiality agreement is if they're really reporting on what he has testified to in court, which is a public document, and he'd be compelled to testify because he's under oath. Because no non-disclosure agreement will allow you to perjure yourself.
It's a pretty genius legal maneuver, Hail Mary.
Yeah, it's definitely a sneaky lawyer trick. And the alternate sneaky lawyer trick on the other side is to get an injunction or
restraining order
against him from testifying. But they can't get it in the state that he's testifying in. Instead, they get it in Kentucky instead of Mississippi.
Yes.
And so who's the lawyer?
Scruggs.
Yeah. Colm Feary from Face Off, The Sum of All Fears, and Jack Ryan, Shadow Recruit. He gives a great performance.
Yeah, and he gets the requisite Michael Mann plane.
Yes, plane shot. Actually, no, but you know, okay, who I'm actually thinking about, that's the main lawyer, or the prosecutor, whatever, but it's Ron Motley, played by Bruce McGill, who I'm really thinking of, who gives the fiery performance.
Oh.
Yes.
Yeah.
The fiery Southern lawyer. He's we know him from Silkwood, The Last Boy Scout, The Sum of All Fears, and Collateral and W. And he's great. He's one of those Johnny Dramas, right? Who you see in everything.
Is he from MacGyver, too?
Yeah, I believe so.
But yeah, he's great. So they are, by the way, suing Big Tobacco to recoup Mississippi's Medicaid payments, which is, by the way, how the states got together and got big settlements against Big Tobacco, is to prove that they created this health crisis that the states had to pay for. Therefore, that's how they were liable for that. Because almost no individuals have ever been paid off by tobacco companies. I think there was one just recently that was like made a big news out of it. Like it was old enough that he could prove that the tobacco companies, or that he was not reasonably assumed to realize that there was smoking was harmful. Anyway, we don't have to get in the weeds about that. But up to this point, Big Tobacco had always won. Always, always, always.
Didn't the original Marlboro Man get a settlement?
Oh, probably. Lots of people, I think, got settlements. But I don't think anybody until recently like got a judgment. Because there's a certain amount of walking away money to give. Like, Wiggins, his severance package was kind of his payoff.
Bruce McGill was Jack Dalton in 18 episodes of MacGyver.
Ah, there we go.
He was also played a different role in the MacGyver movie. He played Detective Greer.
Mm.
I'm sorry. The rebooted MacGyver TV series. He played it. So,
we gonna watch MacGruber?
We could.
I haven't seen it, but I've heard from people that it's like a cult classic.
You should put MacGruber in Talladega Nights.
I have seen MacGruber within the past couple months.
And did you enjoy it?
A lot more than I remembered enjoying it when I saw it in the theater.
Maybe that'd be a good pairing with The Love Guru.
How much alcohol was involved when you watched it at home?
Zero.
Oh, well.
But I think I was just in a better place in my life to be open to that kind of humor.
Telling you, Love Guru, that's it. Never my kind of movie, but perfectly acceptable under the right circumstances.
So, for an early tangent, did you see that there's going to be a new series on the USA Network for Treadstone?
Yes, October 15th.
Oh, not that you've been looking.
I sent you guys the trailer like a couple months ago when it premiered.
I didn't.
I don't think any headliners.
I remembered you sending it, and I was like, I was wondering when it was going to come out. So I just saw it again. I was like, ooh.
Yes. I think I thought it was a tire ad. So back in Louisville, Wiegand starts his new job as a teacher in high school? Maybe private school, something like that.
I think it was a high school.
Yeah, I think it's right. I think he actually won Teacher of the Year at least one year. So, and we have the court scenes in Mississippi. And again, it's all very tense because he gets his testimony down. And early on, by the way, after he after Lowell shows up at his door for the first time, he gets called back in to Brian Williamson, and that's where they do the threats by Andy Travis. And he immediately goes back on Lowell and say, you burned me. You screwed me. You know, how dare you? And so Lowell actually has to come back and tell him, like, in person, no, you can accuse me of a lot of things, but I will never burn a source, blah, blah, blah. Which is why Act Two of this movie is all about Lowell.
Yeah. I mean, but before he goes to testify, he's so mad and feeling so threatened that he wants to get his story on tape. So they go do like a secret taping in New York, right?
Yes, yes. They do the interview. Mm-hmm. So that once they get the court testimony, they all have the package all ready to go and just show the next week on 60 Minutes. It's all good. And it actually shows where Lowell is all involved in the editing process and stuff too. So it's, you know, that,
yeah, I loved the like behind the scenes kind of procedural stuff that had to do with 60 Minutes. You know, all the way from Lowell, like, working a source and developing a source, all the way through getting him on air and then doing the editing. I found that to be really compelling.
Yeah, me too. I kind of wish there was more of it. Although, again, this movie was already long enough. So, unless it's going to be a series. So, he gets it. They have the interview that they can't show yet. But once they get from their lawyers. And, by the way, I really like Debbie Mazur.
Mm-hmm.
It's great.
Every time I see her, I think, oh yeah, she's like, just for Eric, she's like Fairuza Balk light,
kind of. Yeah. Oh, Gina Gershon is in this movie too.
Yes,
and she's like Fairuza Balk mom, or maybe aunt. Not our mom or our aunt. I mean,
Fairuza Balk's aunt. Be careful. Your pronunciation is a little
It all depends on where you put the comma.
Exactly. So, okay.
Semicolon.
So we have this. We get Wigand, who goes through all of this mental and psychic trauma or whatever to finally get this thing done. Damn the torpedoes! He's going to testify, only to return home to find out that his wife and children have left him. Well, his wife has left him, taking the children. So he is kind of feeling empty. And vulnerable?
Well, feeling vulnerable because he might get thrown into jail. Because when he went down to go testify, that's when Kentucky slapped him with a gag order, which Mississippi wasn't going to honor. So he could testify, but as soon as he went back home, he could be arrested and thrown into jail.
Yes.
So he had that, what I thought was a great kind of soul-searching scene. You know, with the ocean in the background, it was very Michael Mann.
Yes.
There were parts of this movie that really reminded me of
Miami Vice.
Going back even further, Manhunter.
Yeah.
Like the scene later when he's in the hotel room and he's got that weird, like, tropical mural behind him.
Yes, that is weird.
That was an extremely Manhunter-esque scene, especially since Lowell was on the beach. Talking to him on the phone.
Yeah. That, you know, I didn't even think about it that way. That makes a lot of sense. Also, I like, by the way, I like Lowell's portrayal in this movie because even though this is based on a true story, so you couldn't just make Lowell a bad guy, I don't think. But this movie actually shows Lowell with like a lot of integrity. Like, he doesn't really push Wigand to do much. He just tries to make the circumstances better for the Wigand to go in his direction. If you know what I mean? Does that make sense? And am I right?
Well, I think he makes the point that if he didn't have integrity, he'd never get somebody else to come forward ever again.
Well, yeah, that becomes clear here because what happens is...
Wait, oh, I think he absolutely manipulates Wigand into giving the interview.
Well, okay.
Because I think that's what he does, and he's really good at it, so he gets what he wants no matter what, but he's got enough experience and he's got what would that be, that'd be like emotional intelligence to really figure out how to connect with somebody and figure out what motivates them to get them to do what he wants.
But
doesn't mean he doesn't have integrity.
No,
absolutely manipulated him.
The problem is when Gershon and Stephen Tobolowsky, right, come in, and say they are CBS's attorneys, and they're like, yeah, we're not, we can't do this. Like, what do you mean we can't do this? It's all legal. Oh, it may be illegal, but here's the thing, is tobacco has enough money, they could bury us, and they could actually own CBS when this is over.
Tortious interference.
Yes, which I like the concept.
It's a thing.
Oh, no, I'm sure, yeah. So we actually get to be the CBS, but it gets to be the bad guys as far as the corporate. Because they're like, no, no, you can do it. In fact, here's what you can do. You can play the video, but you can't play him. You can't show him. You can't have him violating his confidentiality agreement, because that is the torturous interference or whatever. So, what? Hugh Hewitt,
I think.
Hugh Hewitt, yes. Who's the but executive producer of our showrunner of 60 Minutes. He said, okay, well, we'll do this. We'll do it. We'll edit it so that we have the version without his
interview. I thought he was the head of CBS News.
Maybe, yeah. No, that makes sense. So, and then, of course, Wallace and Bergman are like, no, we are going to do this with integrity. We're going to do the whole story. We don't go half measures. And Lowell is giving a big old speech about how this is what's right, and that, you know, the truth will set you free. And it's explained to him, of course, the torturous interference thing, about how actually it turns out the more truth that that Wigand says, the more damages that Brown and Williamson can claim he caused. So it's actually worse for him to tell the truth, and or them to portray him telling the truth. And that's when Lowell has his crisis of, I don't know, it's a crisis maybe. He has his anger at his bosses for saying, hold
you
on.
You can watch his brain break.
Yes.
It being told that they can't run the story because it might be too true.
Yeah. Well, and that, and the fact that he tries to remind people that, by the way, Wigand has already told his story. He has already put himself out on this huge limb, based largely on the fact that Lowell has told him that he will back him 100%. And the only thing that's going to give Wigand, like,
any cover.
Well, he put himself in jeopardy, and his wife and his family in jeopardy. And he at least wants his kids to be able to see the program to say, this is what he's standing up for. This is what, why all this hassle. But if they just bury the story, then he's got nothing. And it was just sold down the river. And so you've got Lowell saying, oh no, don't put me in this position either. So he has this nice speech about how that's what they pay him to do. So, and of course, then Mike Wallace caves too. Lowell expects Wallace to be able to be on his side too, and they can both walk out together, which would be, of course, you know, that's like, that would be a big thing. That's a big weapon. But if Mike Wallace says, nah, I think I'm with you on this one, it's like, what?
Yeah, not a good look. Not a good look for Mike Wallace right there.
Plus, it's also, you know, Lowell has to admit that, okay, he's not going to quit in a huff either. He's not going to quit his job over this. It's going to suck, but he's not going to, you know, this isn't something he's going to get fired for or quit over. So he's just got to eat it, but he's not liking it.
He's pretty much daring them to fire him.
Yeah. Which, by the way, this is where the movie turns from the Wigand story to the Bergman story.
Yeah. Yeah, they pretty much really, like, literally leave a strong metaphor. They leave Wigand twisting in the wind for a long time in this movie.
And so Bergman has a lot of this, some soul searching to do. Although, again, it's not really that kind of movie as much as it is now he's got to figure out how to get this done. In the meantime, Big Tobacco has hired a team of people to... I don't, this may sound familiar to people who are paying attention to the news in 2015 through 19. They created a smear dossier on him, claiming all sorts of crazy stuff. Some stuff is true. Some stuff is made up. Some stuff is exaggerated. But it's all thrown out to all these media companies to basically discredit this guy. Like, they're gonna bury him.
Yeah, it's basically just... barely corroborated, not factual conjecture that's used just as character assassination.
Yes.
Yeah, and much like I enjoyed the behind-the-scenes stuff at 60 Minutes, I really enjoyed watching Lowell just, like, do shit.
Yes.
Because once he figures out what's going on, he's actually very, very reminiscent of Vincent Hanna. He's out on the street making moves. trying to head stuff off at the pass, making his own little plays.
Yeah, I think literally he says, hey, this is my only play to somebody.
Yes.
So, yeah.
And at some point he winds up in Montana. I did not follow that at all.
No, that he was in Montana because that's where Unabomber was. That's where Tim Kazurinsky, not Tim Kazurinsky. Tim
Jesus Christ.
Wow.
Having a good day, vision over here.
Ted Kaczynski.
Tim Kazurinsky was one of my favorite SNL actors ever.
Jesus Lord.
Yeah, but how did he get onto the Unabomber thing?
He had a friend in the FBI. Remember, he was saying, hey, can the FBI do this for me or whatever? And so somehow they were trading favors back and forth. And one of the favors he was asking for was, he was told that after I guess doing a lot of digging and not reporting stuff and being jerked around, he was given his like 3-hour heads up of when the bust was going to happen.
Well, he got the heads up because he went and he pretty much busted the undercover agents at that cafe in Montana.
Yeah, but there was a whole interaction between he and the FBI earlier in the movie. And by the way, I for one of the reasons, I thought the geologist in Montana was actually Gina Gershon on vacation for a bit. I was a little confused. No, it was not her.
Yes.
But
yeah. Anyway, I didn't follow that because the previous FBI scenes, it was him yelling at the FBI guy because FBI agents were not treating Wiegand very well.
Yeah, because of course, Big Tobacco has deep pockets and long arms. So he was getting jerked around from here to there.
And they employed ex-FBI supervisors. Yes,
exactly. Straight from there to the security ops. Which, by the way, that stuff is 100% true. Okay, so we have the scene, actually a very tense scene, where this is another thing. So on one case, we see Bergman going around making his plays. And then on the other scene, we've seen Wiegand in a hotel room, isolated, getting progressively more isolated. To the point where he is locked in his room and he is unresponsive. Like, they peek through the door and see that he's in there not moving. And I thought that was actually, for what could have been a fairly cheesy scene, I thought that was pretty well done. Even that weird warping of the big mural in his room was kind of strange, but worked out. Yeah,
it was very train spotting.
Yeah, I expected him to put pantyhose over his face and start to stroke a tiger.
Yes.
So I expected him to eat a bullet.
I'd fuck me. Okay. That's not a good impression.
That was not a Michael Mann movie.
No, it wasn't. Same series.
Wow. So Diane Lane.
Diane Lane, yes. And Jessica Tandy. Tim Kazurinsky. So, they finally, Bergman kind of discovers that several people, including, well, first of all, that CBS is going to be sold anyway. That was in the works, and having a big old lawsuit against them would hurt their financial status, their worth, or whatever.
How's that free press working out for us?
Yeah. Also, that the Gina Gershon character had a personal stake in the new company or whatever. So she was giving advice, but maybe based on personal motivation. I don't know what that's like in a news or whatever. So they kind of put 60 Minutes into a corner. Oh, no, he does more. He goes to other news sources and says, here, by the way, here's a news story. CBS is not going to do something because it's scared. Here's the story they're not going to tell.
Yeah, what was that, the New York Times?
I think so. Was that played by like Jimmy Breslin or somebody who's a real new Pete Hamill or somebody who's a real newsman? Or he seemed like a real news guy and not an actor, but I could be wrong.
Yeah, I didn't recognize him. I know the district attorney of the attorney general of Mississippi. He had to have been the real guy.
Yeah, he was the real guy. Yeah.
He could not act.
So we have this, you know, finally at the end of the day. Well, they play the interview. And, you know, they've got it on tape that tobacco is a nicotine delivery system, which, by the way, is interesting how that works out, because that's why it is now, that's why tobacco is now under the FDA and vaping things are not.
Well, it took me a couple times to figure out what exactly he was saying. It was really a lot more sinister than that. Because I think everybody believed nicotine was addictive. Did anybody really not believe that?
Anybody who's ever been around a smoker or has smoked knows it's addictive.
I can't believe people were really aghast at the notion that nicotine was actually addictive.
I think what they were aghast about, though, was the level to which the tobacco companies were fostering addiction by nature of enhancing the product to a point where they were taking in more of the product simply in a different chemical form that promoted more of the chemical to get into the body and the bloodstream.
Yeah, and what Wigand was really upset about and what eventually got him fired was they were using a chemical, coumarin, something like that.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes.
That was either a flavor enhancer or it enhanced the effects of nicotine, but it was a specific lung carcinogen, a known lung carcinogen. And he said it was too dangerous to use in a product that you inhaled into your lungs, and was told that they will keep using it until they find a substitute that's just as good, because otherwise it will hurt sales to remove it.
Yeah,
that's some dark, sinister shit. Yeah.
And at the end of the movie, you know, we've got Wigand, who basically gets to be keep being a teacher, and we've got, although his life is still fairly ruined, you know, the life as he knew it was different. And you know, if you get a chance to read the Vanity Fair article, you know, he does come across as, you know, he was just as burnt by 60 Minutes as he was by the tobacco industry. He's like, now to A, he had to watch every single thing he did ever, forever, 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 and watch his surroundings all times. But he also had to remember and contextualize anything in his entire past, because it would all come to be used against him at some point. And, you know, it turns out, you know, everybody's got some skeletons, and he had some, you know, he had some issues. He got caught shoplifting once, and what was the other thing? Some angry outbursts at work and stuff, right?
He had a whole other family.
Well, that's true. Yeah, he was married and had a child. Yeah. Yeah, there's that. Oh, yeah, wait. He left his wife because she had MS or something, right?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, so, yeah, he's not a perfect hero. And, of course, Bergman eventually quit CBS and, as it turns out, worked for NPR.
Which is what Mike Wallace is afraid of ending up doing.
Yes, doing PBS, yeah. Mm-hmm. It's very interesting. By the way, this movie was nominated for a shit ton of Oscars. It did not win any of them. And why? There was one movie in particular that swept a lot of the Oscars that year.
What movie was that?
Do you know, Drew?
99.
I may not need to give you a hint. Okay, here's a hint. It does not hold up to the 2019 cultural appropriateness that we have now, in a good way. I mean, it's got some challenging ideas, let's say, even for the time. And its star has been canceled.
That wasn't The Usual Suspects, was it?
Nope. The Insider was nominated for Best Picture, along with The Cider House Rules, The Green Mile, The Sixth Sense, but all of those lost to Insider. Michael Mann was up for Best Director. Also in the running was M. Night Shyamalan. Yes, Shyamalan for Sixth Sense, and Spike Jones for Being John Malkovich. But they lost to the director of this same movie. I'm not telling you yet. Think about a super big star, actorly kind of star, challenging movie, and that star has been canceled.
No.
I present to you American Beauty.
Oh.
And its star, Kevin Spacey.
Yeah.
Oscar-winning actor Kevin Spacey. Oscar-winning director Sam Mendes. I remember liking that movie a ton.
Really?
But I think it's because it was challenging and it was very beautifully shot movie.
Yeah, sorry, I had the Oscar-nominated shopping bag.
Yes, yes. It had Thora Birch. It had Annette Bening. It had Peter Gallagher's eyebrows. But the entire plot with Kevin Spacey is kind of bad from start to finish.
And what, Christopher Cox, right?
No, who am I thinking of? adaptation. Is that Christopher Cox?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. For some reason the name doesn't sound right, but yeah.
Did I get it wrong?
I'm not sure. Anyway, we need to watch adaptation, by the way. Really being a fucking great movie.
Chris Cooper.
Yes. There you go. That makes sense. Okay. So yeah, he was also, there's also a troubling character. But yeah, the shopping bag was the most, and just to think, actually in 2019, the shopping bag is kind of a villain too, especially yeah. in our hometown of Anchorage, where shopping bags were just outlawed. It's fucking ridiculous, but oh well, it's only ridiculous that McDonald's is charging me 10 cents for a bag. I don't care. I'm happy to pay 10 cents to the Ronald McDonald House, but still, you fucking weren't part of the problem. Why would you?
Yeah, wait, McDonald's is charging for bags?
Yep. And yet,
they never use plastic bags.
Yeah, exactly. And by the way, McDonald's does not want you to put your old used recycled bag through their drive-thru window and fill it up for you. Oh, no. Seems that would actually violate some health codes.
Yeah.
So
it's a huge health code issue.
And I guess if you bitch, they won't charge you. But who's going to bitch about a 10-cent bag? But it's just like...
Oh, you'd be surprised.
Well, yeah. No, I guess I wouldn't because, I mean, I'm bitching about only the idea of it. I don't really care. If you just tax me an extra dollar for going to McDonald's because I'm a fat bastard, that would be fine too. Well, whatever. Okay, so can we talk a little bit about whistleblowers?
Yeah, we should talk about how whistleblowers always get fucked over.
Yes.
Always.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, okay, I can think of one who didn't. We've talked about
that with us.
Oh, you don't want to play this game again? Okay, that doesn't make for good. Good.
Was podcast. It Kevin Spacey?
It was not. Yeah.
And now we've reached a part of our podcast where we call it 5 minutes of silence.
Yeah. No. Okay. How he was played by Hal Holbrook.
Oh, Deep Throat.
Yeah, Mark Felt.
Yeah, because no one ever knew who he was.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. That's the best. That's the most successful whistleblower is somebody who does it and is kept confidential. Turns out it's hard to do that for 100,000 reasons. So, okay, I just have a quick list of prominent whistleblowers that I thought might be worth. I know we have to go into it, but.
Do we want to finish the movie before we do this?
Oh, sorry. Yeah, let's do. You're right. Let's do the. So, any other notes on The Insider?
I took notes okay. for the first time in like 6 weeks, I think.
Oh, cool. We'll share them. Oh, here, let me. Before you do that, here, I only have one note. I thought it was remarkable and actually kind of noble that, I guess, as part of the deal, the real Dr. Wiegand said he would do the movie or whatever, consult in the movie, and they could use his story or whatever, so long as nobody smoked in the movie.
Oh.
And there was like basically, I think, one instance where one of the Hezbollah guys smoked, and that was it.
Huh. I thought the fax machine wars were pretty funny.
Yeah, I like that.
Because that was... I'm not sure that translates very well into this current environment, so...
Fax machines and call me back on a hard line.
I'm beepers.
Oh, yeah, the beepers. Thought of you.
Very quickly, though, I wrote that, boy, Wiegand has a bit of a hot temper. But then I made the observation, like, do people really golf in suits?
No. Although, golf clothes are fucking uncomfortable.
Well, golf clothes, but, I mean, like, in like a suit jacket and tie.
I just assumed that was mayhem.
Yeah, I was not impressed by the wife, but I was impressed that he was teaching chemistry and Japanese.
Yeah.
There was an interesting little moment where I think Al Pacino's character said, the internet said, and I was like, so.
Looked him up on Webcrawler.
Exactly, yes.
Lycos, Alta Vista.
Netscape said, he's got a great ass.
But then there was that quote that Al Pacino's character says, you know, these are ordinary people under extraordinary pressure, which I thought that was a very succinct summation of the entire process.
Which, by the way, I think I'm just going to use that quote when I teach how to do my job about how not to lose your cool.
And this movie... It had a different version of you got a great ass. It did, yes. No, you fucked yourself.
Yes. Yeah, he went full Pacino.
I think Jesse repeated that, boyfriend Jesse repeated that most of the rest of the evening after we watched the movie.
Can I do a quick tangent? Have you guys seen Robert De Niro lately?
Yes. I saw him. Yeah. I saw him drop the F-bomb repeatedly on CNN the other night.
Yeah. I think Robert De Niro needs to retire.
Well, based on...
I saw him at, whose roast was it? Some roast.
Alec Baldwin's roast.
Yeah, he gets invited to roast, which is weird. But he is a doddering old man, too. It's what, I mean, I'm not one of these people, but I can certainly sympathize with people who say, hey, maybe actors should just fucking act. We don't care what they think.
Well, except that I think when you've acted that much and you've earned that much status, then you may have a right to give your opinion. You've earned it.
10 years too late, though.
Well, better late than never.
No. I think he could do. He should do a thoughtfully written piece for like a New Yorker article or something, because he just comes off as kind of doddering old guy.
He's a doddering old guy. What do you want?
But when the president of the United States is actually quoting his movie lines during a rant, during a press conference with the president of Finland, or prime minister of Finland, whoever it is. Are you talking to me? Talk to him!
Anyway, but if you ever find yourself in a situation where somebody can scream at you that you fucked yourself,
yes,
there's no recovery from that.
Yeah, that's true.
You have just lost the argument.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter. Doesn't matter how it came up.
True story.
That's funny. Okay, so, Brother Jay, what's your verdict on this movie?
I really enjoyed this movie. It was, I hadn't seen it before, so that was kind of a nice surprise. It was a good movie as much as I kind of knew where it was going to end up, but I wasn't able to guess most of the character movements, so that was kind of nice. I would probably rate this movie, this is probably, an A-minus movie. I got annoyed with some of the continuity issues, but I think that was just the way that they had designed the transitions in the movie to be. So, but otherwise, I enjoyed this movie a great deal.
Yeah, this movie was definitely worth it. But it was such an interesting movie coming on the heels of Heat. And when you compare it with other Michael Mann movies, it's a really quiet, still movie. There's not much action to it, but it's super intense. And Michael Mann does some really interesting things in this movie that I haven't seen him do in other movies. You know, I'm really, when you think about Heat or Miami Vice, or even Ali, you think of like these really long, close shots of the characters, even if they're not saying anything, kind of lingers on him. This movie didn't linger. There were some intense shots of intense situations, but everything was really fast paced. I noticed it really in the scene at the Japanese restaurant. Because it was just the two of them at this table, but they kept cutting to different angles almost with every sentence. And it wasn't like the diner scene in Heat where it was like back and forth, the same shot going back and forth. It was different shots all from different angles, really quick cuts. It's really unusual. So I appreciated how different this movie was, but it still had that same level of intensity. And you still got to see people who are really good at what they do what they do, which is a Michael Mann thing, because it's always compelling.
And there was a moment, so it was hard for me to guess where this movie was going, which is good. I like that in a movie, because sometimes I ruin movies for myself that way. But I was always expecting much more sinister things to creep in and happen. Like, for instance, they made a big deal when his daughter woke him up and said that there was somebody in the yard, and he took her downstairs to have her draw something while he goes into his gun safe and gets a gun, and then the furnace kicks on.
Oh, yeah.
Like, they made a big point about the furnace, which was, I was like, oh, God, are they going to blow up the house with the, there's all these things. It was I think, a fair bit of misdirection to kind of add some tension early to the scene as it built.
it's also what Eric really hated about Take Shelter. It was just tension, 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 tension without any release.
True. Except that what irritated me about Take Shelter was more irritation, was that I was fairly convinced. And of course I was in a state of mind at the time that I don't know if I, it would be the same state of mind now, but I was in a state of mind at the time where all I saw was the darkness happening. It was just, everything kept getting worse and worse and worse. I'm like, this is going to end so horribly and I'm going to be so angry. I think the fact that they kind of like zigged and zagged, like we went from.
Oh, I can't wait till we watch Arctic.
Yeah, well. Yeah, we'll see.
Have either of you, neither of you have watched it yet?
Drew has.
Oh, yeah, I watched it. I couldn't sleep.
Yeah, yeah, it affected Drew in a profound way.
Yeah, I know we can't talk about the ending, but God damn it.
Although I think I suggested maybe you guys could talk about that movie. And I'd be happy to watch it and listen to you guys talk about it, but anyway.
I think it's well worth a watch for you. I think it's important that you watch it. You don't, I mean, if you don't engage in the discussion, but I think it's something that I think we would benefit talking together.
Okay. That works.
And I don't know if Mother Anderson has watched it yet.
Well, we'll find out. So, okay. Anything else on The Insider?
Nope.
Yeah, I thought it was pretty good. Thank you, Drew. I probably wouldn't have watched it anytime soon otherwise, because it's kind of in that slow-sounding movie. Mm-hmm. But realizing who's involved in it, like, yeah, I should have trusted all along.
It had a great cast.
It did. Great cast, great director. What are we, it's a compelling story. I mean, what's not to love?
Yeah, and I can't stress enough how weird this movie was in the context of coming right after Heat.
Oh yeah.
It's such a weird choice.
But well, so I think good. it was a definitive at the time, this is a definitive political statement.
And you could see where, because it's not American Beauty, it's not The Sixth Sense. It was probably the safer of the Oscar choices that year, except for Cider House Rules, which is also a really good movie, just more Oscar-ly.
Is it? I remember not liking that movie.
It had Michael Caine in it. What's not to like?
But it also had Tobey Maguire in it.
And Spider-Man. What do you like about Spider-Man?
I've seen Molly's Game. Tobey Maguire's the worst.
I haven't seen Molly's Game. Is it worth watching?
Yeah, I liked it.
Okay, so can we transition into... Actually, do we even want to talk about whistleblowing, or do we want to talk about politics? Because shit has happened, and guess that goes... It's a straight line from...
Are they not the... At this point, are they not the same thing?
So how are you gonna
parse that?
Here, I'll segue this way, inartfully, but I will do it this way. This is the part of the show where I try to avoid the sentence. Webster defines whistleblowing as, but also saying that, you know, what we're talking about when we talk about whistleblowing is that a person who exposes secretive information or activity that's either illegal, unethical, or incorrect within a private or public organization. And you can do it either internally, like up the chain of command, or you can do it externally through, like, the media. Now, internally, usually has some negative consequences, up to and including getting fired. Code red kind of thing going on there also. And then, of course, externally through the media, that will definitely get you fired. And, you know, again, it can also get you trashed. Your life can be ruined through so many reasons. And, yeah, Drew, I think you hit the nail on the head. And as our grandmother had said, advice from her father was never be a whistleblower. You're being a martyr. You are tacking yourself up to a cross. So I guess traditionally you didn't tack yourself up to a cross. But anyway, yeah, you were putting yourself in a situation where you are not going to come out okay. You just hope that the good you are doing is the good that you want to see in the world. Famous whistleblowers that we've talked about include Karen Silkwood. Of course, also Mark Felt and Daniel Ellsberg from the Watergate things and the Pentagon Papers. Historically, and this one, as I was looking through the list of notable whistleblowers, I skipped a lot of like military whistleblowers and stuff because it wasn't pertinent to our discussion here today. But Linda Tripp from the Clinton impeachment, Monica Lewinsky situation. I remember at the time, partly because I was sort of a left-leaning, well, still I'm left-leaning, but I was more of a dyed-in-the-wool, not questioning too much about just being a Democrat. And I was younger also, so I thought, well, Linda Tripp is just the worst friend. Like, she basically set up her friend to expose the president. But as it turns out, she was probably a terrible friend, but as it turns out, you know, her friend was being taken advantage of in an illegal way by a creepy boss. And she knew it and could prove it. So she disclosed the information to the independent Office of Independent Counsel.
He was taking advantage of her in an illegal way?
Yeah. I mean, from an employer-employee relationship, she was being sexually harassed 100%. And then he tried to destroy her, but that's a whole different deal. That was probably after Tripp got involved. Well, I mean, yeah, she was of age and stuff, but
so sexual harassment is sexual harassment when the victim defines it as such. But at the point that it was happening, I don't know that it was illegal.
Well, okay, immoral, let's say.
Yeah, I mean, I agree that it was immoral.
Certainly unethical, given the power, the difference
yes.
in the power.
Okay, yes, you're right. You're right. Unethical,
yeah,
for sure.
Yeah, yeah.
And yeah, because the illegality didn't really come until he perjured himself.
Correct.
And as it turns out, also...
It's never the crime, it's the cover-up.
Yes. Sometimes it's the crime, though. but also, again, I forget, because Linda Tripp was just, especially like Saturday Night Live, you know, made fun of Linda Tripp. I mean, everybody made fun of Linda Tripp.
They skewered her in the press. They skewered her in the comedy vaults. I mean, she was made fun of on talk radio and all of that.
The Clinton administration, Department of Defense and Justice Department, because didn't she work for the Department of Defense, I think? They leaked security information and employment information about her. She won a $595,000 suit against them, or got a settlement, for a violation of the Privacy Act of 1974.
Nice.
They took her down. They tried to. And she ended up, because she got a retroactive promotion and retroactive pay for that promotion for like 3 years or something, which is a hefty bunch of money, I'm sure. Got her pension back. And was cleared to work for the federal government because she was not. She was fired from the federal government.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, again, she's, I don't know, historically. And so the Clinton thing was problematic for several reasons. But, yeah, I think of her as much more of a villain at the time than I do now. I mean, maybe I could actually definitely see now that maybe she thought she was doing the right thing. And maybe she was. I mean, there was an independent counsel looking at the president. You got stuff to say, you know, now's the time. I mean, isn't silence violence? Or are we mixing metaphors and stuff? But there's been so many, like for instance, I don't know, Chelsea Manning, Edward Snowden. Again, I think I'm on record, not that I need to be on record, but I mean, I think Chelsea Manning as a whistleblower, great. But he should be in jail still. She should be in jail still, sorry. Yeah, Edward Snowden? Yeah, if he ever comes back here, he's going to be in jail. No doubt about it. No choice. That's the way it should be. That's how these things work. Of course, again, these are extraordinary circumstances. also because I think it didn't change enough. If it had ended the war in Afghanistan, that would have been great. And then he could be a hero. Putting his life in jeopardy. I guess it falls under the category of, you know, the winner writes history.
Right.
You're either a terrorist or a freedom fighter, depending on who tells the story.
Well, that's interesting, because who won the Clinton scandal?
I mean, theoretically, Clinton won the Clinton scandal, right? I mean, he didn't get punished at the time, like booted out of office.
He didn't get removed from office, but he was impeached.
He was. He can't be a lawyer anymore.
Yeah.
It's funny. Hearing people who were actually involved in the Clinton stuff are actually admitting, too, that, hey, they people were blinded by party loyalty and disdain for the other side. It's like, you know, if Clinton's your guy, it's like, well, no big deal. He lied about sex. Everybody's that. Move on, right? But if Clinton's not your guy, it's like, oh, no, he perjured himself. We can't have somebody in the highest office of land who doesn't have the ethics of not perjuring himself. Which could lead us to today, where we talk about how we have a president who is likely to be impeached for, I don't know, asking a foreign government to investigate his political rival for his own personal gain, and continues to do it daily now.
Yes. other countries.
Yeah.
Pretty much any country he can think of now.
Yep. Yeah. This is a time where he also called and congratulated China on their 70th anniversary of the Communist Party. Anyway, so Drew, I'm sorry you missed out on last week's interesting conversation about about impeachment a little bit. What did you think of the conversation, I guess?
No, it was a good and interesting conversation. It was a weird coincidence that you guys were doing the front runner.
Oh, there was right? no coincidence. That was shoehorned in at the last minute.
Well, at least you didn't have to watch it for too long. I mean, so much is going on now that I am trying to absorb all of the news and conversation I can. So it was quite enjoyable to listen to you two talk about it.
Are you really? I'm actually trying to ration myself to how much news I watch because I can't absolve myself of the angst and anger enough to be able to be calm enough to sleep otherwise.
No, I want to know everything.
Yeah, I think that's my problem too. I want to know everything, but I have to remind myself constantly that we don't know anything. Like all these day by day dribbles, I want every bit of it. I want every piece of news there is to digest. But what we have now, I just got to remember that it's just a ton of speculation for the most part.
You're being waterboarded, basically.
By who, though?
By the media.
I don't know. They're giving me what I want, though.
To a degree. Well,
they have used Coumadin into my lungs to make me want that news fix.
Coumarin.
No, I know, but it's similar to Coumadin, he said. Yeah, I want that fix. I want that news fix. And I read everything I can, even sources that I hate, I want to read just because I want to see what that slant is. And I want to try to parse, like, what is Lindsey Graham's angle on this? And what is Mitch McConnell's angle on this? And what is Nancy Pelosi's angle on this? And who are people that are just kind of laying in wait and taking advantage? And who are getting sucked into the vortex of this thing because this thing has a power of its own now?
Yeah, it's really... So I certainly was not around for Watergate, but I was around for Clinton. And I was in my early 20s when the Lewinsky scandal happened. So, you know, at a time when I was mature enough to really be interested in the news and understand what was happening.
And also about Monica Lewinsky's age.
Yeah. And I remember, you know, I was also young and full of, you know, what righteous vigor. And so I remember what really offended me the most about that entire scandal was the hypocrisy by all of our politicians. Is this the obvious hypocrisy that the Democrats were showing by trying to dismiss something as being about sex, just about sex, when it certainly wasn't just about that. But even if it was, if it had been a Republican, you know, they would have done everything they could to bury him just based on a sex scandal, for sure. Yeah. No doubt in my mind.
No, 100%.
So that hypocrisy just really turned me off. And so it feels like everything's coming full circle now. And I find it very entertaining to watch folks like Lindsey Graham having to contort themselves like a circus performer to try and justify why this scandal shouldn't really be a big deal when he was stumping daily to remove Clinton from office as it being the worst offense in the history of the presidency.
And his quotes about how it doesn't have to be illegal. It just has to be conduct unbefitting of the president that has, like, will trounce the name of the president and our government forever if we don't take a stand today.
Well, a couple things. I have a real problem with this because I find myself screaming in the shower at times because I don't have anywhere else to scream where I won't scare people. That when the fuck are the adults, supposed adults, in our government going to act like responsible fucking adults and do something? Because while Bill Clinton and his impeachment, it was an impeachable offense and he was impeached and rightfully so. And yes, It was something that he should not have done, and it was bad for him, and it was bad for her. But it didn't rise to the level of engaging foreign governments and actions bigger that will have effects long-lasting far beyond the administration's reach. Years and damage that we can't even quantify. So my problem is that history, I hope, looks very unkindly, but that won't happen fast enough. And in the meantime, our republic is being damaged, and our status in the world is being lessened, and our safety is at risk, and we have someone in charge, purportedly, who is not, I think, of his full mental faculties. And that's what I'm most concerned about, because there is no adult in the room. Listening to him talk to foreign leaders on stage in front of the press, there is no adult in the room.
I don't know, maybe the older I get, the more I realize that maybe the adults in the room have always been mythical. Or maybe people just were forced by society to act like adults when they had to. But ultimately, everybody is doing their own craven interests.
But, I mean, do you understand what I'm saying?
No, I know. I know. I mean, during the Clinton thing, you could say, look, this kind of stuff has always been happening. We have the Kennedys, certainly John Kennedy, and we have Franklin Roosevelt, and we've got probably plenty of presidents in the past have had all sorts of sexual and moral, like, peccadilloes and stuff, but I don't think there's any analog to what's happening now, right? I mean, can you think of anything historically where...
No, but I think the point that I was trying to inelegantly make was... So Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky, and there were some ripples from that, but that was largely it was isolated to their circle, and it wasn't engaging the government to do anything against another government. It was individuals, and it wasn't government business. Purportedly, this person in charge is engaging other governments.
Oh, not purportedly. We've watched it happen.
This is on a scale that is exponentially so much larger that I can't. That's. I just can't fathom
and
that.
At what point is that not witness tampering? Is that we can't charge the president with witness tampering? I mean, he's basically he's suggesting very strongly that the whistleblower is committing an act of treason, or sorry, the person that told the whistleblower the information is committing an act of treason, and suggesting that, oh yeah, in the old days we used to do something different about spies. Like, yeah, that's a death threat.
Mm-hmm.
That's no different than what the Brown and Williamson characters did in the movie.
Yeah. What I am really looking forward to is all the other shit that's going to come out.
Okay, so you had sent us a text that you were disappointed that we didn't bring up one topic last week that Jason mentioned, actually, but I hadn't thought about it enough or realized what the meaning of it was. But tell us a little bit about Mike Pence.
By the way, I didn't sleep after that text.
Oh, about why Trump was probably dragging Pence into it?
Yeah. Yeah.
So, I will preface what you're going to say with, I don't know that he is intelligent enough to come up with that, but I'm sure somebody who is trying to prop his power base up is smart enough for that. So,
yeah, no, he certainly didn't come up with it. But yeah, so if Trump is removed, Pence will be president for the remainder of his term. So there could be some thoughts among the Republican Party that we got to get this lunatic out of here because he's damaging the party, but at least we will still be in power and be in good shape for the upcoming election. Because the incumbent party always has an advantage. But if Trump drags Pence down with him and they are both removed from office at the same time, the next in line is the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi. So it's another one of Trump's dog whistle message is that, yeah, if you take me down, you are going to put your political rival in charge in the office of the executive.
Well, isn't that what Nixon sort of did, sort of wanted to bank on the fact that that Spiro Agnew was the vice president? He's like, I'm unimpeachable because no one wants Spiro Agnew to be president.
Yeah, I mean, putting aside whether or not you'd want Pence as president, yeah, I mean, that really is sending a message to your own party that you are going to have to damage yourself if you want to take me out.
I mean,
and it's really diabolical, and it's politics at its most dirty, right?
Yeah, it is. It's no longer behind the scenes. It's no longer like a it's no longer shameful, I guess. If it's not witness tampering, then I don't know what witness tampering is. And I don't think I think what Jason you were talking about hit home, because the sex stuff or whatever, or I mean, even the Nixon stuff is not as I can't believe that Richard Nixon would be asking the Chinese or the Soviets to do his dirty work for him. At least he asked Americans to do it, you know, or he had Americans, you know, hire Cubans to deal with the Cuban part of it. But if this doesn't qualify you to be removed from office, I don't know what will.
Oh, I don't think it'll happen. I don't think he's going to get removed from office.
Well, I don't think so either. No, but I mean, how do the Republicans live with themselves?
Because they don't care. They would rather remain in power than do the right thing, because that power gives them the ability to do all the other shit that they want to shove down everybody else's throats. Look at all of the litigation that is pending, that is being pushed, that is going to the Supreme Court, all of the wish list of the Republican Party.
No, I know.
The abortion's rights, the ending of public health insurance, guns. The fact that he had a meeting with LaPierre to have the NRA pay for his impeachment defense should be enough to get him removed from office on its face, and there is nothing happening.
You know, that's the thing, is that I wish there were heroes on the other side. Maybe there will be. I would be delighted to wake up in a couple months and not having been asleep the entire time, of course, because I'm on the couch right now, to find out that somebody like finally said enough is enough, or grew a pair of testicles, or whatever other I guess less colorful language we want to use. Somebody who finally says, no, this is wrong. You know, and hey, I would love it to be Lisa Murkowski. If Lisa Murkowski and was it Susan Collins or whatever and Mitt Romney like form some sort of coalition. Again, like the Brexit thing. Just to unite against this particular evil. Like, and somebody has to be able to say, this is our party. This is, you know, if you believe in the ideals of the Republican Party, you know, that's not what this guy is about.
Except that the base that voted for him don't care.
I don't care about the base. I just care about anybody who's been elected doing the right thing.
But the base is powerful enough to possibly get him reelected.
Who are the swing voters? Because it's a very small number of people, right? I mean, there are lots of people that are the base of the left who aren't going to, you know, they're never going to vote for Trump. And you've got a ton of people who are going to vote for Trump just to thumb their nose at the other half.
But the problem is you have the fucking goddamn, you have those people on the left that if they can't have the candidate that they want, ideally, they're just going to sit it out because, like, I'm not going to vote for somebody I don't want. So if I can't cast a vote for somebody that I really want, then I'm not voting for anybody, which is such a fucking chicken shit, white privilege bullshit attitude. So you're willing to make everything worse just to have a protest. That's some adult maturity. That's some real responsible behavior. That's, nobody's ever perfect. Nobody's ever going to be a perfect candidate. I don't vote for a candidate who's perfect. They don't happen. I have to pick somebody who I think is going to do the best job of the people available. And sometimes that's somebody I don't necessarily like. I voted for people I don't like, but still at the end of the day, they're there to do a job. But having a protest that does nothing but harm you is baffling to me.
Oh yeah.
But that's the problem, is that gets stirred up on the left that these people won't vote. And so enough of them don't vote that the swing votes don't get big enough on the left, the moderates. And then the right base is energized because, of course, you know, you get all the Aryan racist Nazi bullshit, racist propaganda, whistleblowing crap that just dog whistles the whole dog and pony show together.
I still think that there's the fringes of both parties. Yeah, they can both go fuck themselves.
The problem is the fringe of the right vote and the fringe of the left won't. That's the problem.
Except, well, here's the other thing. So here's another problem with the left. So the left, they just have some policies now that are going to make it very difficult for middle of the road people to vote for. I mean, how are you, you know, what are you going to have? Like middle America, is Kansas going to vote for free college and reparations and gun control? You got to pick and choose, man, because that whole package, you know, in a green revolution or whatever, all at the same time, you know, incremental steps. And I mean, Kurtz, you know, Gretchen Thurberg, whatever her name is, Greta, whatever her name is, the 12-year-old.
Yes.
Yeah. Great. Whatever. Wonderful. I don't want to be led by a 12-year-old in the revolution, by the way. Although, a very powerful speech he gave. I don't know. It just seems like it's easy. Maybe it's, I don't know. Am I suggesting it's easier to scare the right? I mean, it only takes a couple things to turn you off from voting against somebody. It's like, hey, they're going to, you know, for the lefties, it's like, oh, yeah, anti-abortion. It's like, I'm not going to vote for somebody who's going to take women's rights away, right? The Republicans aren't going to vote for somebody who's going to take your taxes and pay for something that you don't believe in. So where do we find the middle ground? And when, you know, it used to be, so the primaries are a great time when you get all these crazy ideas or whatever. And so the parties kind of swing in the harder positions during the primaries. And then that kind of whittles down. And when you finally have your candidate, then everybody kind of goes to the middle because you're fighting for everybody, you know, fighting for the votes of all of common America. This particular president isn't going to change his position. He can stay way out on, not even the right. He can just stay out in like Looney Town.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's safe to say I am the most conservative of the three of us. I don't think I've ever voted for a Democrat, but I do have like sort of a mental flow chart when I think about a candidate I'm going to vote for. And one of the first boxes when you're going through this flowchart is this candidate a corrupt, narcissistic racist?
Yeah.
If that's a yes, you don't vote for him.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it seems pretty straightforward. Doesn't matter if he's the conservative nominee. You don't vote for him.
Because, I don't know, you have principles and standards, and there are lines you will not cross. I'm just trying to figure out how to draw a line that, I mean, like, because the line keeps getting fuzzier, and if, yeah, if somebody like Lindsey Graham doesn't value their own reputation enough, that was another thing that would work against you. Like, that's why Nixon resigned. Nixon wasn't going to put himself and his own legacy through being impeached.
Nixon had respect for the office enough to resign.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And he could read the writing on the wall.
The incumbent does not have any such respect.
No. Well, he can't read. He doesn't read anything if it's more than like a one page and has lots of pictures on a page. Not even joking. Just not even an hyperbole. And the fact that, okay, so this impeachment thing, you do this stupid, arrogant thing, and then you have the hidden, secret, classified, whatever, extra classified safe that you put the stuff in that you don't want anybody to see.
Mm, yeah. The double secret probation safe?
Yes, nothing wrong with that, of course. Yeah, nothing could be horrible in that. And then the fact that he all along, like, you know, I think Oprah or somebody had a, it probably came from somebody else, but has a quote saying, you know, believe people when they tell you who they are. He has never not told America what he's all about. Mm-hmm. And he is not one to say, like, he, again, he told what Lester Holt that, oh yeah, he fired Comey. Like, yeah, fucking A. I did it for political reasons. All these other people tap dancing about, you know, like, now you have all these, again, Republicans in the Senate who are tap dancing about how, well, there was no quid pro quo and you've been against this president from the beginning. Yeah, we're going to talk about Ken Starr, who had how many years of consistent digging up of Clinton stuff that started out with Whitewater and ended up with Monica Lewinsky, which is kind of hilarious. Yeah, this isn't even that. You know, this is you're saying, oh, he didn't mean that. And then he comes out the next day and says, oh, I meant that exactly. And I'll tell you authoritatively, standing in front of a helicopter so I can claim not to hear your question completely later, but still.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is the stuff that he doesn't think is illegal. I think there's no question that he does stuff that he does think is illegal anyway, because he's certain he'll get away with it. That's the kind of stuff that's going to come out. It's all going to come out.
But this is a guy who he doesn't pay any bills, right? He doesn't pay his taxes. He works, he uses other people's money. He is a parasite on society, and he thinks he's the smartest guy in any room. And it's, I don't know, who's gonna be able to stand up? I mean, you know, he is now, remember last week or the week before I mentioned that maybe I thought somebody had adjusted his meds, and Jason said, no, that's the depression part of manic depression. Well, today he's back on the mania.
Yeah.
200 something tweets in 10 days. That doesn't tell you anything. It's awry with that.
I still don't understand how people don't seem to care what will be written about them in history, because this will be talked about and written about, and the people right now that are making excuses and not doing anything about them are probably likely not going to be very well referred to in our history. Hopefully. I'm hoping that the responsible adults in the room will accurately record the stupidity that is occurring. But then again, I don't know. Because this republic may just get burned down to the ground in the next term if he gets reelected.
Well, the advantage of a civil war is maybe Alaska can maybe wiggle their way into Canada. We have very common interests. Be a seamless. We wouldn't have to worry about a border, right? And actually, no one would miss Alaska because they didn't even know where they would. He wouldn't know where to send the missiles. Yeah,
couldn't find it on a map anyway.
He would bomb the coast of California expecting to hit Alaska and Hawaii.
Yeah, I don't either. And living in a sanctuary city doesn't help, so.
Yeah, see, you live in the most liberal of the places. Like I'm a light blue guy in a very red state, but
well, but also don't forget, I live in a very blue city in a very red state. Sure. So Portland has enough population that Portland is hippie liberal blue, but the rest of Oregon is very red. So there is sometimes a power struggle where red and blue is pretty equal in some ways. So it becomes an issue when we come to elections, because sometimes it gets very, very scary. I'm just tired of it. I'm so tired of it. Like, stop telling people what to do with their lives. Stop telling other people what they can and can't do with their own lives. When your life starts to affect me, you're taking my rights away. If you want to do something with your body and your life, that's fine. You have no right to go beyond that. And that's what the crazy right would like litigated. We want freedom of religion as long as it's my religion. So other religions are not acceptable.
Rand Paul Anderson there with his libertarian views.
Well, like I said, I'm a hippie liberal policy-wise, but fiscally I'm pretty libertarian. But I say this many times, I wish common sense were truly common. It's not anymore. And I don't understand. But then I see people who are graduating from high school and can barely function. And so our system is failing in many ways that is starting to affect and will continue to affect the next generation and the generation beyond in ways that we can't repair readily. Our infrastructure is crumbling. Our education system is overloaded with inadequate funding. What's there is expensive and in some ways elitist. So if you're not a person of privilege or a person of money, you can't get education. There's just so much going on that it's like, you know, I'm worried for the future and I don't have children. So that's what keeps me up at night.
Just a slight tangent just to break tension. So,
you know, all tension.
Journey broke her foot last week, and so she's been sleeping in because Kelly and I have an adjustable bed, so she's been sleeping in my side of the bed so she can
elevate
her leg and blah blah blah. And so, frankly, if she needs to go help to get to the bathroom, you know, hobble of course to the bathroom in the middle of the night, it's better to have mom do it anyway. So I've been sleeping on the couch. But the other night, Journey rolled over and fell off the bed and slammed her wrist against the nightstand on her way down. So she has a big bruise on her wrist. I'm like, you can't break any more bones, child. But she was explaining later that she was having a bad dream. And it was about dulce de leche. Which is like, you know, like a caramel kind of thing. It means three milks, she says. Like,
yes, okay. It's true.
No, it's not. No, that's tres leches. It's like, you're close there, you know. But yeah, so she's dreaming of dulce. She's dreaming a caramel dream and fell off the bed and hurt her hands. So oh, God. Only to dream about desserts. That would be a joy. But I don't know. What's the future, Drew? When are you going to run for office?
Never.
Wise choice.
No one would vote for me. I'm not likable enough.
Well, it'd be rude for me to come on.
We both know you're asshole enough. Come on.
Now, it turns out you don't have to be likable.
Yeah.
Oh, maybe. I don't know. See, the thing is, actually, that's not quite true. Trump is completely likable to the people that like that kind of thing. Very charismatic. And as he told that little boy, he is Batman.
Racist. That's what you mean.
Well, yeah. Not just racist, but people who were like, this guy is not politically correct. He says the way he is. So he's wrong a little bit. You know, I can get behind that. And if I happen to own a Confederate flag and don't have any friends of color, that's just coincidental.
Racist. You guys need to watch Years and Years.
Okay. Oh, that's the... Yes. I think you were telling me about that.
It's on HBO.
Okay. Years and Years. And it's not very long, you said?
It's 6 episodes.
Okay. So it's doable. Mm-hmm. Is it like Chernobyl, but with politics?
Maybe. I've only watched the first episode, and it stressed me out so much I had to take a break.
Okay, cool. Years and Years.
I don't know if I can handle watching something any more stressful right now.
It feels very relevant.
What is it about?
It's about a British family in the near future.
My problem with things lately is that boyfriend Jesse wants to watch all kinds of certain things. Like, let's watch something scary. And I'm like, you know what? I have enough scary stuff in my life right now. I don't need to watch scary stuff. I have enough problems sleeping. How about I watch something that's some escapist fun rather than some scary stuff? So having said that, then, of course, we then are also simultaneously making plans to go see the Terminator movie on November 1st. So
I have high hopes.
Do you?
Well, hopes, not expectations.
Are you guys going to see the Joker?
No.
No.
Yeah, I'll see it on video. I want to see it, though. I've heard nothing good but good things about Joaquin Phoenix's performance, although I read a review in The Guardian just saying it was like the most disappointing film of the year just because of the hype. That he was really good, but maybe the story wasn't as good.
The director, every time he talks, he's sounding more and more like a grade A douchebag.
Well, but again, that doesn't disqualify you from being president of the United States. Hey, speaking of grade A douchebags, but not, I want to thank Jay for sending me a link to the Noel Gallagher episode of what is the program called? The web program where you eat progressively hotter wings.
Hot stuff.
Yes.
You can. So hot ones.
Hot ones. Hot, yeah. Ones.
You can thank Boyfriend Jesse for that particular link. Although I was the one before Boyfriend Jesse. I used to watch other episodes long before that. Because I found it a little off-putting, but also sometimes a little hilarious. It's sometimes some real schadenfreude to watch.
Yeah.
Especially when they have people on and they have the vegan wings.
Oh, I haven't seen that.
Like, what?
Like, well, the premise is it's a show where you have, what, 10 levels of progressively hotter hot sauce. I mean, starting with relatively minor and going all the way to, like, basically stunt hot sauces that you would never actually eat in the real, in the wild. But during the program, the person is being interviewed and you're supposed to carry on a cogent interview at the same time. And I thought Noel Gallagher did a great job.
I actually haven't watched it yet. I wanted to have time to really immerse in it. So I'll watch it on the TV. I don't want to watch it on my phone.
Okay.
So,
well, I won't give any spoilers away, but, yeah, it turns out, and it's not just his accent. It turns out, he may be an arrogant guy, but he's articulate.
Have either of you listened to Liam's new album?
I have not. I've heard good things though.
Not yet.
It's different.
The difference is not bad.
That's not bad.
I didn't even know that Noel had his own band now, a different band.
The High Flying Birds?
Yes.
They've been around for years.
I did not know that. Of course, I'm a Fairweather and relatively new Oasis fan anyway, so.
Liam's got a documentary out.
It'll be interesting.
It's supposed to be good.
Yeah, I'm sure.
It's on its way to me when it's available. I'll share it.
Any other politics thoughts or anything until we bid adieu for at least the recording?
I did have something. Music, movies, we were talking about. Oh, I very much enjoyed the Tom Cruise crazy that you interspersed in the episode. Yes.
I had never heard that before. I don't know anything about Jonathan Coulton other than he had a cruise with a bunch of comedians on it.
Jonathan Coulton is the greatest. I can't recommend him enough. He was like I think he was a business guy, but I couldn't swear to it. And he just had a not fun career. And so he quit and just started doing this weird thing with music. And he had a website where it was like a song a week and it started to get downloads. And then he started to get fans and built up a base and all this crazy stuff. But, you know, like he has a cover of, Baby Got Back and, so he's got all kinds of interesting stuff on and now on iTunes, you can actually get like the Song of the Week album, volume one, volume two, volume three. But, Code Monkey is a great song. Re Your Brains is a great song.
He didn't write the song about zombies, right? I Just Want to Eat Your Brains.
Yeah.
Is that his?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. He's also known to gamers as he does a cover of the Still Alive song, which is the end credit music when you finally finish the game Portal. So,
is that original to Portal, or is that a song that they put at the end of Portal that was a regular mainstream song?
I think it was created for Portal. So. But I don't know the genesis of it.
You're not thinking about Love and Rocket So Alive, right?
No.
Oh, it's Still Alive.
Still Alive. Okay, yeah. Got
it. I love that Love and Rocket song. Actually, a lot of that Love and Rockets album is really good.
I recall that you had much enjoyment for that.
your hair is long and brown.
Hey. So I'm glad that you you're gonna go look at the Joko, because he's got some great stuff out there. It really is worth spending some time. Just hilarious. If you ever see interviews with him, he is also just hilarious. So, what else? Jonathan Coulton. Still following the Brexit cast. Today was the Poisonous Testicles episode, so that was interesting.
Yeah, it's going to be an... Oh, by the way, so I sent you guys a text here on Brexit news. Here's the latest offer, okay? The Irish backstop. You know, the big thing about the Irish backstop is that it's needed because the fact that there is not supposed to be a border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland is what is essentially the Good Friday Agreement in a nutshell. And so the his solution was, well, obviously you're going to have some sort of stop where you go through and check people and, you know, there has to be some sort of checkpoints or borders or whatever, but we won't make it on the border. Well, what we'll do is we'll have checkpoints a couple miles on either end of the border, so you'll have two borders, border crossings you'll have to do.
Makes sense.
So, of course, the EU is not going to like that, and therefore no deal Brexit. Woohoo! Things are more immediately fucked for our friends across the world. Things are truly eventually fucked for us, but oh well.
Just... Oh, Jesus.
And yet, much like what could happen to us, Boris Johnson could step on his dick for months and months and months, screw this whole thing up, and still get reelected. Also, did you see that there apparently is no rule against... He could be impeached, run for removed from office, and then run again.
Who?
The President of the United States.
Well, impeachment doesn't remove you from office.
No, I know. But if in the Senate he is found guilty of high crimes and misdemeanors and removed from office, he could still run again, as has happened to judges who have been impeached in America today.
Yeah.
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 Federal judges removed from office for financial crimes and misdeeds are now United States senators and representatives.
Or worse. Like, what was it? The Chief Justice of one of those southern states with the Ten Commandments thing. Wasn't he the Chief Justice? Was it Roy Moore? Who was the Chief Justice that refused to take down the Ten Commandments memorial? The Supreme Court ordered him to do it, and he said no, and they fired him, and then he ran for, I think, their Senate. He didn't make it, because, of course, then the accusations came out that he was, you know, boinking the underage girl.
Flirting with young high schoolers when he was a 35-year-old guy.
Yes. Yeah, so... Yeah, no. I am so tempted just to pack up and move to another country.
Yeah, what country?
That's not the UK.
What country? Canada's not looking great either right now.
I don't know.
Mexico, you can lose your head.
Iceland looks just peaceful.
Just take a magic carpet ride up to Canada. It's fine.
Exactly. Yeah. I can see Russia from my house, so I'll just paddle across the water there and use my Gorky Park impression and just fit right in.